Regardless of the approach, everybody should be looking at the first slide, which is our official title slide for today. As a reminder, on that same seminar homepage, there was a complete description of today's session, as well as contact information for our instructors, as well as myself, and that page will continue to remain up after today's event. So if you have follow-up comments or questions, you can certainly refer back there to communicate with myself or the instructors. Again, everybody should be on slide number one. Those of you who are joining us on the phone lines, I do hear a number of people hopping on the line and some background noise. So just a reminder, please place your phone on mute. You can use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your phone right now. That will help greatly cut down on background noises, which could be disruptive to today's session. Don't put the call on hold either. There could be background music again or commercials, which will interrupt our speaker. If you need to, you can certainly hang up the phone. There are no tones when you come on or off, so you won't be disrupted if you have to hang up. And you can dial back in again without disrupting us. So just keep us on mute. Use your own mute button or hit *6 to mute the line right now. Those of you who are streaming audio online, that won't be a concern for you. We will provide instructions when we go through today's session in terms of how you can ask questions for the instructors. But in just a second, I want to remind everybody to move along to slide number two, which covers the remainder of our housekeeping items. Those of you who are streaming the audio, we will be able to take yourselves off of mute at designated times to go ahead and ask questions directly to the instructor. At that point, I'll provide a reminder instruction that if you hit *6, you can unmute your phone and ask the questions directly. Those of you streaming audio, though, can certainly type up comments or questions at any point in time using one of the buttons located at the top of your slides online. If you are viewing the slides online, you'll be able to navigate through the materials at verbal cues from our instructors, either using the numbered links that appear on the left side or using the arrow buttons that appear along the top of the slide. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. Again, if you need to or would like to submit a comment or question at any point in time, you can click the button that has a question mark icon on the top, and a new window will open up, so you want to be sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled. And you can type up a comment or question that I will read on your behalf at the appropriate time. You don't have to wait till Q&A breaks. Anybody can type up a comment or question that way at any point in time, and we'll just queue them up and get to them at the appropriate point. You can also use that very same approach to report any technical difficulties you may be encountering. Just a reminder, though, please include a telephone number where we can reach you to help troubleshoot the issue. Our instructor today, again, Joe Bress from the EPA's Brownfields program, will be indicating as he moves through the materials. So again, each individual person will have to turn the page at his cues. There will be time for questions at the end of the session, as well as a designated break. So again, just hang tight if you're on the phone lines, or go ahead and type up those comments at any point in time. A reminder, though, that today's session is being recorded and will be archived on the CLUIN Internet Seminar page that you'll be able to access and either download or replay the archive session in a few different formats within about 2 weeks. If you are interested, you can certainly just refer back to the CLUIN training calendar at cluin.org/training and follow the links for archive seminars where you can browse through the over 370 different archive sessions that are available there. Or if you prefer, we do have a free podcast available on iTunes that you can subscribe to. At the end of today's seminar, you'll see one final slide that we'll include, which will point you to two important pages. The last one is a resources page where you can download today's presentation, as well as a few other resources that have been collected relative to today's topic. The other resource that I will point you to is a short feedback form. If you are looking to receive credit for today's session as part of a CEU or PDH program, while we don't offer those directly through CLUIN, occasionally the accrediting institutions will take a copy of the agenda or seminar homepage along with the slides and a confirmation email that you can have sent to you if you maintain those records. So if you're looking for a confirmation email, you'll need to fill out the feedback form and check a box at the end, which I'll point you to again at the end of today's session to have that email sent to you for your records. I think those are the end of the official reminders that I have for today's session. So again, we're going to segue over to today's topic, which is, again, Fiscal Year 11 Job Training Grant Guidelines, which has been sponsored by EPA Region 6. And just a brief overview before I turn things over to Joe. EPA provides funds to eligible parties or entities, including nonprofit organizations, to deliver environmental workforce development and job training programs focused on hazardous and solid waste management, assessment, and cleanup associated activities. Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training, or EWDJT, grants are now provided to recruit, train, and place unemployed and underemployed, predominantly low-income and minority residents, historically affected by hazardous and solid waste sites and facilities, with the skills needed to secure full-time sustainable employment in the environmental field and in the assessment and cleanup cleanup work that's taking place in their communities. This was formerly referred to as a Brownfields Job Training Grants Program. The Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grants Program supports expanded environmental training outside the traditional scope of just brownfields, but builds upon the existing model and capacity created through the Brownfields Job Training Program since its inception in 1998. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to our instructor. Again, this is Joe Bruss coming from EPA's Brownfields Program. A final reminder, please place your phone on mute if you haven't done so already. You can use the command *6 to mute your line, and I'll direct everyone to move on to slide number 3 to officially begin today's presentation.
Thanks, Jane. Hi, this is Joe Bruss. Again, thanks for joining our call today. This is our third CLUIN outreach seminar conference call that we've held, and again, we're excited about the expansion of the job training grant program this year. I'm going to try to jump through the slides pretty quickly so we can have some time for question and answers at the end. Region 6 is sponsoring the call today, but I'm filling in for Amber Perry, who was unable to lead the call. So I'm happy to do this. And before we jump into it, I just want to make clear that the Brownfields program here at EPA, we have several grant competitions and funding opportunities, including the assessment grants, cleanup grants, revolving loan fund grants, and then we also have our environmental workforce development and job training grant program, which I'm going to talk about today. So we're on slide 3. First, I just want to provide a brief history of the Brownfields job training grant program, give you some context of how we arrived at where we are today. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the competition itself, getting started, the application process, and then I'm going to talk about our two different criteria, the threshold or eligibility criteria, and then our ranking or evaluation criteria. Also talk about the attachments, application tips, next steps, other resources, and again, we'll have some time for questions and answers. Next slide. Here's just a picture. This is Milwaukee Community Service Corps job training class, one of our successful grantees. And then I'll go to the next slide on slide 5. The history of the program. The first seeds of the Brownfields job training and of the Brownfields program itself really emerged in the 90s, reflecting EPA's growing concern for environmental equity, later known as environmental justice issues. Among the lessons learned from the very first EPA Brownfields pilot grants was the realization that the communities surrounding Brownfield sites were not benefiting from the job opportunities created by their assessment and cleanup. EPA realized that these Brownfields-related jobs were being filled by environmental professionals from other cities due to a lack of environmental training among local workforces. Next slide. While EPA had no resources allocated for job training during the initial years of the Brownfields program, the agency had already collaborated with the Hazardous Materials Training Research Institute, HMTRI, to offer environmental education and training program assistance to community colleges located near Superfund and other hazardous waste sites. With the goal of adding a job training component to the Brownfields program, EPA tapped the expertise of a number of federal entities with established job training programs, including the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Next slide. This is just a little timeline for you. In 1995, EPA announced the first Brownfields pilots. We're talking assessment grants primarily. To go out into communities and conduct environmental assessments. For those who don't know, brownfield sites, think idle blight or idle properties, blighted communities, abandoned buildings, old warehouses, industrial properties, old mills, factories, the Rust Belt, Cleveland, Pittsburgh. Most urban areas have brownfield sites. Brownfield sites, they do have to meet several eligibility criteria, but really in a nutshell, it's where there's not necessarily contamination, but perceived contamination. So lying idle or abandoned, and developers historically didn't want to touch them because of the liabilities that were associated with them. Brownfield sites also include abandoned gas stations, mine-scarred land, meth labs, and the list goes on. So brownfields isn't just an urban issue, but also a rural issue. In 1996, EPA signed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Labor focusing on job training and employment opportunities related to the Brownfields program for local youth and adults. In 1998, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences established a Brownfields Minority Worker Training Program in collaboration with selected EPA Brownfields pilot grantees. And in 98, EPA awarded its first 11 Brownfields job training pilots to entities including cities, community colleges, universities, and nonprofits. Next slide. Finally, in January 2002, the Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act was signed into law. This became known as the Brownfields Law and amended CERCLA to specifically authorize federal financial assistance for brownfields revitalization, including grants for assessment, cleanup, and also job training. In 2003, EPA awarded $2 million for brownfields job training grants in 10 communities. And to date, the agency has funded 169 job training grants through the former Brownfields Job Training Program, totaling over $35 million. Currently, I believe our stats show that more than 6,600 participants have completed training, and more than, I think it's approximately 4,700 have obtained employment in the environmental field with an average starting hourly wage over $14 an hour. Next slide. In 2010, EPA's Brownfields program is leading an effort to more closely collaborate on workforce development and job training with other programs within EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. For those who aren't familiar with the organizational structure of the EPA, and I don't expect you to, the Brownfields program is part of the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. And under that umbrella, other offices which we're partnering with in 2010 include the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. They're working on RCRA issues, the Superfund program, the Office of Underground Storage Tanks, the Federal Facilities Program, the Center for Program Analysis. They're looking at preparing formerly contaminated sites for renewable energy. Also, we're partnering with the Office of Emergency Management, and our Innovations Program. Next slide. So the goal of this collaboration and partnership with these other programs in OSWR this year is to develop a job training cooperative agreement opportunity that includes expanded training and other environmental media outside the traditional scope of just brownfields. As a result of these discussions, the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Program, formerly known as the Brownfields Job Training Grant Program, will now allow applicants to deliver additional hazardous and solid waste training. This also supports OSWR's community engagement initiative. Next slide. Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grants train residents of communities impacted by a variety of waste facilities, blighted properties, and contaminated sites for environmental jobs that cleanup contractors may otherwise fill from outside the affected community. Through the expanded program, graduates will develop wider skill sets that will improve their ability to secure full-time, sustainable employment in various aspects of hazardous and solid waste management and within the larger environmental cleanup and remediation field. We know from the past that brownfields assessment and cleanup work oftentimes is short-term and contractual in nature, and what our program has really strived to do is not just to train and place individuals for short-term work. We really want to train individuals for full-time employment, for careers, not just in remediation, but really the environmental field. Next slide. Program requirements. Proposed training programs must target unemployed and underemployed individuals. Applicants will be evaluated on the extent to which they have partnered with local contractors and other stakeholders working on EPA-funded projects, including brownfields, federal facilities, Superfund, underground storage tanks, landfills, oil spill sites. If you're on the Gulf Coast, oil spill is obviously something that a lot of organizations are training individuals to do. And also EPA-funded state or tribal corrective actions or closures at solid or hazardous waste facilities or landfills. Applicants should establish procedures to ensure that graduates will be employed in environmental work that involves preventing, assessing, managing, and cleaning up or cleaning up contaminated sites with a focus on the graduates' respective communities. So applicants really need to target the point of the program is really to provide an opportunity for those who've been historically affected by contamination or unemployment or, you know, poor economies in their neighborhoods to really benefit from redevelopment. That's really why the program was created. EPA's Brownfields Program and OSWA are committed to integrating principles of environmental justice by helping communities revitalize contaminated sites, mitigate potential health risk, and restore economic vitality. It goes without saying that really the majority of individuals who are entering these programs are those that have suffered from terminal unemployment or barriers to unemployment. Our program really targets largely, I would say, approximately 65% of individuals entering these programs are ex-offenders. We have single mothers. We have those who've fought drug addictions. You know, the list goes on and on. But I do want to make a point that you know, the program also, we want to target dislocated workers. The agency is really involved in, you know, the auto sector closures. There's a lot of communities that have had, you know, huge plant closures. And we also want to target individuals maybe who have more education or experience working than those that we may have traditionally focused on. But we really still want to make the linkage that we're recruiting individuals from those communities that have been hardest hit or from communities where there are brownfield sites. You know, we want to try to make that connection. So I'll get into that a little bit later, but we also target dislocated workers through this program. Next slide. So the core curriculum, all environmental workforce development and job training program curriculum must include 40-hour OSHA, hazardous waste operations and emergency response, the HAZWOPER certification. We're also requiring that you deliver lead renovation, repair, and painting, the new RRP certification. And also, as a result of our partnerships with these other programs, we have to ensure that, when I say other programs, I mean like the Superfund program, the Office of Underground Storage Tanks. Applicants are also going to be required to deliver some level of training in the following categories. Innovative and alternative treatment technologies. You might ask, what exactly does that mean? We're talking about solar installation training or phytoremediation, stormwater management, bioswale systems, site preparation, soil amendments, green remediation, and then also the leaking underground storage tank prevention training. We'll also require training related to solid waste management, assessment, and or cleanup. This includes construction and demolition debris recycling, landfill remediation and capping, recycling center operator training, et cetera. Next slide. So we've gotten a lot of questions that, well, you know, EPA wants us to really develop our curriculums based on the hiring needs in our communities. but we're turning around and saying you have to include all these different types of training. So the way that we're approaching this is you can choose to deliver those three additional types of training in some type of awareness level. So if you are in a community where there's really not underground storage tank issues or solid waste related issues, you can choose to deliver just a basic awareness level type of training for that. We want to be flexible ultimately, but we also want to encourage that if you are a community where there's a Superfund site or federal facility site, that you're really focusing on your training curriculum on that site and preparing individuals to get the jobs that are there at that site. So we're now on slide number 14, supplemental training. So while traditional curriculums have focused on hazardous waste training, EPA encourages applicants to supplement core curriculums with additional specialized training in innovative technologies or other environmentally sustainable training. Directly link supplemental training with the employer needs in your community. And on the side here, we have a list of other types of training that you might want to include in your curriculum based on employer surveys and the hiring needs in your community, such as weatherization, industrial and or oil spill response, hazmat and heavy machinery operations, green building design, fire remediation, again, preparing sites formerly contaminated for renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal, stream restoration, ecological restoration, native plant revegetation, demolition and debris recycling. If you're a tribe, maybe you're interested in freon extraction training or white goods recycling. Also energy auditing. The list goes on and on. So, you know, something that's great about this program is that you can largely design your curriculum, but you do have to include some of these required types of training. We want to make sure that individuals who complete this program have a solid core foundation in health and safety. The last thing we want to do is to have people leave this program and they aren't trained in health and safety. Next slide. So what are some of the type of jobs? You know, we all hear about the green jobs buzz term. I would say historically most of the graduates that have completed this program, they're really environmental technicians. They're doing site sampling, you know, groundwater sampling, soil sampling. It also could include a recycling center operator, emergency response technician, energy conservation specialist, a GIS technician. Some programs have delivered GIS training or blueprint reading. A lot of programs, I would say 80% of the programs are delivering supplemental training in construction skills. If you have a solid foundation in construction, whether it's carpentry or plumbing or one of the trades, that's going to help you achieve long-term employment. Health and safety technician, the list goes on and on. A forklift operator. Next slide. The competitive grant process. So historically, EPA has set a high standard for successful job training grant applicants. In past years, an average of 1 out of every 4 applications was funded per solicitation. From year to year, 90% of previously unfunded applications were funded after reapplying. So for those of you who may have applied in the past but you weren't successful, please, please resubmit. Statistics have shown that those who reapply usually are successful. For FY11, the total estimated funding available for the program is approximately $4 million. EPA anticipates the award of 13 cooperative agreements or grants with maximum values of $300,000 each for a 2-year project period. In the past, we funded grants up to $200,000, so we're seeing a slight increase this year. But with that, I also want to let folks know, you know, the competition has become more competitive. In the past, we usually received, you know, a little less than 40 proposals. You basically had a 1 out of 3, 1 out of 4 chance. Under the Recovery Act competition, we saw more proposals than we ever saw before. We also had more funding available, but we received, I think, approximately 90 proposals, and we funded 15. Last year, under our regular fiscal year competition, I think we got approximately 72 proposals, and of those, we funded 12 or 13 grants. Next slide. So to begin the application process, this says in early October. Obviously, we're now in November. The request for proposals or the request for applications is not yet out. That's kind of good news if you're just new to this and getting started. So you have some time. We do have a copy of the requests for applications. We also call them the guidelines or the application guidelines. They're on our website. That's at www.epa.gov/brownfields. And you'll see the job training grant guidelines there. Those guidelines might change a little bit. So be prepared. There might be a few changes in there, specifically due dates, etc. But you can also go and click on the grants and funding link to find a copy of the guidelines available for download when they're actually issued. The guidelines will also be posted on our website and also on www.grants.gov. Applicants may choose to submit application packages either in hard copy, paper format, or by submitting a complete electronic version via grants.gov, actually www.grants.gov. I just want to let folks know that the government has had issues with grants.gov recently, so don't wait until the very last hour to submit your application through grants.gov. Electronic submissions aren't always as promising or as hard copy. So, sign up for the Brownfields listserv to receive automatic notifications of when our guidelines are issued. You can go to the Brownfields homepage, which I just told you, and sign up for the listserv if you haven't done so already. Next slide. Getting started. Hard copy submission only. Applications must submit 2 complete application packages, including all the documents identified in the forthcoming proposal guidelines. Complete packages must be postmarked by the closing date and time for receipt of application packages. 1 complete package must be sent through regular mail, express mail, or courier to each of the following recipients. Environmental Management Support Incorporated, that's our contractor, and you can send a copy of your proposal to Keith Arnold, and also make sure if you're submitting hard copy or electronically to send it to the EPA Regional Job Training Coordinator. That'll be listed in the guidelines. Electronic submission. Again, we anticipate that you'll be able to submit through grants.gov, but we might also have another email address where folks can submit their application packages. The next slide here, this is another successful program that we have. It's Oregon Tradeswomen. You'll notice this is an all-female training program. Great program. Next slide. We're now on slide 20. Threshold criteria. These are the eligibility criteria which are evaluated on a pass or fail basis. The first one is applicant eligibility. The second one is the required training, which I went over a while ago. And also, the third one is the funding amount. Make sure that you don't apply for over $300,000. Pretty straightforward and easy. Applicants that received a Brownfields job training grant from EPA in fiscal year 2010 are not eligible to apply for the coming competition. Again, the guidelines are anticipated to come out in the next few weeks. EPA will notify applicants who do not meet the threshold criteria within 15 calendar days of the failed determination. Proposals that meet the threshold criteria will then be evaluated based on the ranking criteria disclosed in Section 5B, which we're going to get to. Applications that fail any one of the threshold criteria will not be considered further. If you are a nonprofit organization, you must submit 501c3 status, proof of 501c3 status at the time of application submission. We're now on the next slide, page 21. Applicants must demonstrate they're eligible. Eligible applicants include, again, nonprofit organizations, municipalities, quasi-governmental organizations, government entities created by state legislators, regional councils, redevelopment agencies, states, tribes, and unfortunately, under our statute, we have a restriction that tribes in Alaska are not eligible. Workforce investment boards are also eligible to apply, colleges and also universities. If you're a minority academic institution, we're trying to do a lot of outreach this year to MAIs, also historically black colleges and universities, tribal community colleges. You're all eligible to apply. Next slide. All environmental workforce development and job training curricula must include, again, the OSHA 40-hour HAZWOPER certification training, and this training needs to be delivered to all individuals in the program who complete training with your grant funds. Also, the lead renovation, repair, and painting, or the RRP training, again, that needs to be delivered to everyone with these grant funds. And then also the other types of training, underground storage tank leak prevention, awareness training, innovative and alternative treatment technology related awareness training, solid waste management or cleanup-related awareness training. Next slide. Proposals that request more than $300,000 or with project periods in excess of 2 years will be returned to the applicant for revision. Next slide. Application packages must substantially conform to the outline and content detailed in Section 4C, Content and Form of Proposal Submission, of the forthcoming guidelines, or they will be rejected. Pages in excess of the page limitation for the transmittal letter, so this is your cover letter or transmittal letter, needs to be 2 pages. The narrative proposal is 18 pages. The narrative proposal will include your responses to the threshold criteria and also the ranking criteria. The attachments is 20 pages. We'll get to the attachments list. So that's a total of 40 pages. Please, please do not submit pages in excess. I've seen proposals fail because they just simply didn't follow the directions for the page limitation, and we don't like to see that. All application materials must be submitted in English, including support letters. If we have anyone on the phone today from Puerto Rico, please make sure to submit your proposal in English. Do not include binders, spiral binding, or color printing. Photos and graphics will also not be considered. The transmittal letter and narrative proposal must be typed on letter-sized paper with a font size no smaller than 12 points. Next slide. We're now on the ranking criteria, or the evaluation criteria. This is how your proposal is going to be evaluated. Applicants must directly and explicitly address all criteria as part of their narrative proposal. Each application will be rated under a point system with a total of 100 points possible. Each application will be evaluated according to 6 evaluation criteria. Each of the 6 criteria is comprised of subfactors that vary in scoring value. Next slide. Some of these point distributions may change a little bit based on when the final guidelines are issued. But I think that you'll see that these ranking criteria will remain largely the same. The first one is community need, 20 points. Training program description, anticipated outcomes and outputs, that's 27 points. Programmatic capability, 15 points. Institutional capacity, 8 points. Community and employer partnerships for 22 points. And your budget and resources at 8 points. Next slide. So we're now in community need. This is your first ranking criteria. Describe your target community. What are its demographics? What are the impacts of these demographics, and how do they relate to current challenges and environmental justice concerns? Describe your target community, including the population, location, history, and environment. Provide community demographics. Include unemployment, poverty, and foreclosure rates, minority populations, sensitive populations, recent economic disruption data, information on health disparities, etc. Discuss how these indicators of need relate to current challenges and environmental justice concerns. Provide the source of your information. To what extent will you recruit and train specific populations indicative of need, such as ex-offenders, veterans, etc.? If you are in a community that people generally know as a community where there's great need, say you're an applicant from Detroit. We all know that Detroit, there's a lot of, you know, unemployment there right now. But if you don't list it in your proposal, then we can't give you the points. Don't assume that the reader knows your community. I think this is really the easiest criterion to get points. You just simply have to describe it. Environmental justice. Environmental justice, I mean, traditionally has meant that we're looking at the disproportionate siting of hazardous waste facilities in a low-income or minority community. Maybe there's a huge number of brownfield sites or abandoned gas stations. Perhaps you know about the exposure pathways in your community that individuals have been exposed to arsenic, or, you know, don't give us so much general health indicators such as, you know, there's a high incidence of diabetes in our community or obesity. You know, try to tie it to the actual sites if there's, you know, suspected contamination. Maybe you don't know whether or not there is actually a release at the site, but, you know, try to make a connection there. Next slide. Describe the negative impacts these hazardous waste sites have on the target community. I kind of went over this. Make sure that you talk about the economic, environmental, public health, and social issues in the community. Provide examples of specific sites if you can. Economic impacts include loss of tax revenue and presenting an obstacle to investment. Environmental impacts include potential contamination of air, water, and soil. Social public health impacts include adverse health effects on community residents and blight. Be descriptive. Make sure your response is compelling. Make the reader cry, we say. Emphasize the specific benefits your target community will receive if you are awarded this grant. Be careful to ensure a connection between your community statistics and the focused area of your project. So don't try to give us neighborhood statistics if you're focusing on a specific neighborhood. New York is huge, so don't give us general New York statistics. Next slide. Have you conducted any employer surveying or local labor market assessments? Describe how you know of the local demand for skilled environmental workers. List specific activities you've done, including research conducted. Describe the procedures you used to conduct a labor market assessment. Discuss the results of your assessment. Is there a need for skilled environmental professionals with certifications? Are those certifications proposed and incorporated into your curriculum? Are these certifications directly applicable to the hiring needs of employers within your community? Maybe you think that preparing sites for solar installation or, you know, renewable energy sounds like something really great and exciting. Or maybe you think that phytoremediation is really nice. One super important thing that we said for years is do not train for the sake of training. If it's not directly related to employer needs in your community, you might not want to include it in your curriculum. We do want to encourage curriculums that are comprehensive, that are going to provide a diversity of skills to graduates of the program. Maybe some of the skills won't be as, they won't relate to employment as much as other skills, but, you know, do not train for the sake of training. Also, labor market assessment information. If there's general labor market assessment information, you know, I've seen proposals that say, based on a report conducted in 1994, there's, you know, going to be a strong demand for professionals in hazardous waste in our community. I think, you know, maybe that's kind of helpful, but really if there's employer surveying that was conducted, we contacted 10 different contractors and engineering firms in our community. They've expressed an interest in not only hiring individuals of the program, but also they are looking for individuals with the following certifications. That's the type of information that we want to see. Next slide. Describe the structure of your proposed training program. Present a clear and concise description of the proposed job training program, including the number of training cycles, the number of hours per cycle, a description of core training and required training versus supplemental or awareness training, the number and type of certifications to be earned, whether courses will result in a state or federally recognized certification versus a certificate, the name of courses, and the scheduled classes. Perhaps you find out that based on the individuals that you've recruited that it might be best to have a training program where there's evening classes. These are types of things that we're going to be looking at. Maybe you're going to have weekend classes based on, you know, the individuals of your program. Maybe there's a large number of individuals who are underemployed. Maybe they're just making minimum wage and they've expressed an interest to get into your program. That's fine. So try to reflect that in the way that you design your curriculum. Again, we want to see comprehensive curriculums. We want to see innovative types of training. And we also are really hoping that this year we'll see environmental training or hazardous waste or solid waste training that's related to other sites outside of just brownfields. The description should match the training program outline attached to the proposal. So this is your first attachment, a training program outline. Next slide. What are your anticipated enrollment and placement numbers? How many participants do you expect to enroll in the proposed curriculum? How many students do you anticipate will complete the proposed training program? What is your targeted placement rate of those students that complete the program into environmental remediation jobs? Do you have a detailed plan for evaluating your progress toward achieving expected short and long-term project outcomes and outputs? To what extent is your proposed timeline for achieving deliverables clearly identified, detailed, and realistic? This year, the acceptable minimum placement rate for your program is 70% placement. In the past, we had it at 65%. It's way too low. We know that, you know, placement is a huge issue right now. You really, really have to have jobs ready for individuals when they complete the program. A lot of people ask, well, what's the number of individuals we're supposed to train with this grant money? I would say we don't have a set number of individuals that have to be trained or placed out of the program. We have the 70% placement rate, so we do have the placement, but depending on if you're an urban community versus a rural community, we'll take that into consideration. It's probably going to be a lot easier for you to recruit individuals if you're located in a big city versus if you're a tribe or if you're located in rural Montana, for example. Typically, I would say that you should try to look to train a minimum of probably around 25 individuals per cycle. And then you'll probably have at least probably 2 to 3 cycles for the grant period. We bumped the money up this year to $300,000, so we want to see more individuals getting trained through these programs. We're also going to look at how comprehensive your curriculum is. if you're going to propose to deliver 10 different certifications, that's a pretty comprehensive curriculum. So maybe you want to have as many individuals. I talked earlier about dislocated workers. Maybe you're going to have different tracks to your curriculum. Maybe one will focus really on the hazardous waste training, and then you might have maybe an energy track where you're going to deliver weatherization and energy auditing training. Maybe you're going to have dislocated workers who are interested in getting some of the training, but they only need the 40-hour HAZWOPER, or maybe they just need refresher training. So, you know, we're going to look at all of these different things. Again, the focus of this program really needs to be on those that have been terminally unemployed. You can train dislocated workers that might have a lot of education and experience, but they've been unemployed for a while now. But really, the core of your training program should focus on those who've been terminally unemployed, those that don't have a bachelor's degree, or, you know, they haven't completed a trades program, for example. Next slide. How will you recruit and screen students for your job training program? What strategies or tools will you use to market your environmental workforce development and job training program? Tell us what methods you will use to recruit applicants. Newspaper, radio, posters. Maybe you're going to have a community-based organization partner who's going to do a lot of recruitment, someone that's really in the community day to day. From which areas in your community will you recruit? Tell us what criteria you'll use to screen applicants. Are you going to require a high school diploma? Do they have to be drug-free? You can use your grant funds for drug testing. What level do they read at? Most programs, they require that you're at least 18 years old. How will you address retention and attrition issues? Will students be responsible for any fees? This is kind of a leading question. We hope that students aren't going to be responsible for any fees, whether that's licensing, certification, or medical examination fees. Are training facilities accessible? Meaning, are they close to public transportation, near parking facilities, et cetera? Next slide. To what extent will your organization provide job search support and resources for participants of your job training program? Something unique about our program, which a lot of people get angry about, is that we do not allow funds to be used for life skills training. The funds can strictly be used for environmental training. You can use your funds for personnel costs, fringe, supplies, travel, but we do not provide funds to support life skills training. The Department of Labor has millions of dollars of funds, so we really look for a connection or a partnership with a local workforce investment board, a one-stop center, someone that has the WIA funds that you can tap into to really leverage these badly needed resources. Tell us how your organization will assist with initial job placement, retention, and continuous employment for participants. How and for how long will your organization track graduates? We require that tracking must be a minimum of 1 year after graduation. Describe any local hiring incentives, such as first source or local hiring ordinances, tax incentives, wage subsidies, etc., that will increase the likelihood of employment for graduates. Make sure that you answer this. Maybe you don't have a first source hiring ordinance in your community. I know that not everyone lives in California where they have all these different incentives, but there are federal incentives. Make sure that you do your research and tell us about it, because these are incentives that we really want you to use to market your program with employers. Next slide. Just generally speaking, too, I mean, many times we have applicants such as community colleges or academic institutions. They really have the technical expertise. Maybe they have the strong environmental expertise. They have a program with industrial hygienists, health and safety experts, but they've never stepped a foot in the community before. or they don't know anything about life skills training or their social services side. On the other hand, we have those applicants, such as a local nonprofit that's really been in the community for a long time. They know everything about social services and basic job training, life skills training, but they don't know what a brownfield is. They don't know anything about the environmental training. This is where we look for the partnerships. Partnerships are crucial. We're now on slide 34. If you've ever received an EPA Brownfields grant, please respond to the following. This is the programmatic capability. This will also be evaluated by the regional EPA representative, who may, if you've received grants in the past from us, they will provide a score on this specific criterion. Identify up to 5 EPA Brownfields grants you currently have or have received in the past. If you work with EPA on a Superfund job training initiative project, please mention that here as well. Demonstrate how you successfully managed the grant and successfully performed all phases of work under the previous or existing grant by providing information on the balance of grant funds not drawn down on or funds remaining, compliance with the work plan, schedule, terms and conditions, and timely quarterly and financial status reporting, whether or not you reported in our online reporting database, which we call ACRES, the Assessment, Cleanup, and Redevelopment Exchange System, that's what ACRES stands for, and any other required submittals. Success in implementing the goals of your EPA grant funds. Next slide. If you've ever received an EPA Brownfields grant, please respond also to the following. Describe any adverse audit findings. Provide information regarding your accomplishments. I don't need to read this verbatim because you have this in front of you. Next slide. If you ever received an EPA Brownfields grant, please also respond to describing the management system you have in place to direct the activities under this grant. Tell us about your staff or the qualifications of the key personnel who will be working on the project. Again, note, in evaluating responses, EPA may consider relevant information from EPA files or from other federal grantors to verify or supplement information provided by the applicant. Next slide. If you have not received an EPA Brownfields grant, but you have received other federal or non-federal assistance agreement, please respond to the following. It's basically the same information here. Next slide. If you never received an EPA Brownfields grant, but you have received other federal or non-federal assistance, again, you have the same criteria here. Next slide. We're now on slide 39. Right. If you never received an EPA Brownfields grant but have received other federal and non-federal assistance agreements, please respond to describe any adverse audit findings. I already covered this. And describe how you corrected or are correcting any problems. Next slide. For those applicants who've never received any type of federal or non-federal assistance agreement, please indicate this in your proposal, and you will receive a neutral score of 10 points for this criterion. I would say most applicants, they've received some kind of financial assistance. If you received a private grant, tell us about it. You know, make sure that you try to convey to us that you have experience in managing grants, whether federal or non-federal. Next slide. Tell us about your organization's or partner's experience in delivering an effective environmental job training program. Illustrate your experience working with minority, unemployed, and/or underemployed individuals within your targeted community. How does your experience relate to your proposed curriculum? Describe your involvement with individuals or organizations listed in your attached reference list. As a means of demonstrating your relevant experience, EPA will consider information from other federal agency files. So maybe you are a private university or academic institution full of PhDs. They have really done a lot of great things in their program. But again, maybe they have never stepped foot out into the community. We're going to look for trainers that have experience working with the target population. Next slide. We're now on slide 42. Institutional capacity, subfactor 2. Provide information regarding your training provider's experience and success in delivering a job training program in the target community. If a provider has been selected, what criteria did you use to select this provider? This is where you're going to tell us that you followed the federal procurement procedures and that you competitively bidded or you will do a competition. If you've not identified an instructor and are considering subcontracting or subgranting to acquire these services, what steps will you use to ensure that they are qualified? What steps will you use to ensure the instructors have the necessary skills? Next slide. Demonstrate that efforts have been made to collaborate with brownfield stakeholders and or Superfund, federal facility, leaking underground storage tank, or EPA-funded state or tribal regulated corrective action or landfill closure contractors in your target community. Have you made efforts to enhance or foster employment opportunities for job training graduates in your target area? Have local organizations made commitments to assist with your training program? For example, to provide on-the-job training or hiring graduates. Perhaps you have a partnership with the local environmental nonprofit or with a union, and you're going to do mentoring to trainees in your program. Excellent. I highly recommend that all applicants try to form some type of advisory council, which is composed of a diverse group, meaning business and industry, nonprofit, community-based organization, academia, etc. Make sure that you provide letters of support from these organizations. Again, if you're training individuals to work at a Superfund site, you should have a letter of support from the contractor who's doing the cleanup on the Superfund site. I strongly recommend it. I also recommend that you contact your state voluntary cleanup program, or if you're a tribal applicant, that the tribal program send a letter of support making the linkage with the voluntary cleanup program or the tribal program. Next slide. Discuss your plan for involving the affected community, such as local community groups, workforce investment boards, and academic institutions located in or near the affected community. Explain any early steps you've taken to notify the community about your program, such as conducting public hearings, visual advertisements, radio announcements, etc. I strongly recommend that you have some type of public meeting where you solicit input from local community residents or individuals and partners that will be participating in your training program. Have any partners committed to providing non-environmental training, such as GED attainment, life skills training, placement assistance, personnel protective equipment, or PPE, etc.? Make sure that you attach letters of support of these commitments from these organizations. Maybe you're targeting single mothers. Maybe an organization is going to provide child care support. Make sure that you give us a letter of support. To what extent will your program ensure trainees are job-ready and have the pre-employment skills needed to secure full-time work? Again, we don't provide funds for life skills training, but it's a critical component of this program. Next slide. Have local employers and community-based organizations, such as local businesses, environmental contractors, labor unions, or site owners, been involved in the development of your proposed job training program? If so, describe any components they've been involved in, such as curriculum development, advisory councils, apprenticeships, mentoring. Maybe you're going to have an internship program. Please provide letters of support. Have any employers committed to hiring graduates of your program? Hopefully the answer is yes. Next slide. Is your budget clear, detailed, reasonable, and appropriate? So we're now on the budget criterion. Do you include cost estimates for each of your proposed activities? And is there a narrative explanation for each task? Please make sure that you include a budget narrative. You know, I've seen lots of great charts. The costs look eligible. They look reasonable. But if you don't give us a narrative explaining how you arrived at those costs, you're not going to receive the full amount of points. Include a short introduction before the budget chart outlining how you intend to spend the grant. After the budget chart, explain each of your tasks clearly and completely, including the basis for the estimated cost as well as the projected outputs where possible. You can use some of your grant funds for travel costs. I recommend that you include at least travel to one or two Brownfields conferences for one or two employers of your program, and that you include travel costs to attend the annual grantee meeting. Note, this is where many applicants lose points. Something else that's really huge that I don't think has been covered yet, we're on the next slide now. Do not include tasks for activities or costs that are ineligible to use the fund under EPA's grant. Unfortunately, because of the statute, grant funds cannot be used for administrative costs or overhead costs. If you're a university and you have really high overhead costs, you're not going to be able to use the grant funds for it. Direct costs for grant administration are ineligible even if the grantee or subgrantee is required to carry out the activity under the grant agreement. A list of prohibited uses of funds can be found in the appendix. Don't use acronyms like CBOs. Spell them out. Allocate travel funds to attend the National Brownfields Conference and the All Grantee Meeting. Make sure your budget table adds up. Next slide. Here's a sample budget chart. I'm not going to spend too much time here. You'll see the different categories: instruction, outreach, program management, other tasks, and your total. Next slide. We're on slide 49. Did you demonstrate how you'll leverage additional funds or in-kind services to carry out your project? Describe additional sources of internal or external funding already in place. In-kind funds. Show how EPA grant funds will be complemented by these additional funding sources or in-kind services, such as staff time, life skills training, pre-employment training, GED preparation, childcare, academic enhancement, placement assistance, counseling, transportation assistance, etc. If you don't already have additional funding sources in place, indicate when and where you plan to look. Indicate how these additional funds will stimulate economic development after your program has ended. Describe how your organization will manage this grant in light of the administrative cost prohibition. Something I say on every outreach call is,
Hello?
We'll do some questions at the end. I'm almost done with this. But something I tell applicants is make sure that you watch how you write the language in your proposal. You know, we would love to see applicants that say, we have held a public hearing and solicited feedback from a diverse variety of stakeholders in our community, versus an applicant says that we will hold a public meeting. You know, we want to see that most of these things have already been done. That's going to indicate to us that you're serious about this. And yes, the same holds true for leveraged funds. If you say we already have funds for to support life skills training here, or we have staff who are going to volunteer and provide time to support this activity, great. I know that times are tough right now. You might not have other outside leveraged funding to support your training program. So be creative. Tell us about the in-kind services that you have. Again, access the WIA funds. Next slide. Attachment. The first attachment, documentation of applicant eligibility. Your second attachment should be references. This only needs to be like one page. Don't give us reference letters, but give us a list of references. The third one is your training program outline. The fourth will be your milestone schedule and also your general support letters. Next slide. Applicants that are not cities, counties, tribes, or states must provide documentation or evidence of current nonprofit status. Evidence of nonprofit status must be submitted at the time of application. This will not count against the attachment page limitation that you have. Next slide. Your references list. These organizations may be contacted by EPA during the evaluation process. Include a list with contact information, not letters, from the following: two employers who've hired past participants of your job training program, if applicable; two neighborhood and or community-based organizations aiding in the development of your program; and two organizations from the employer community, such as local businesses, environmental contractors, or site owners that have been involved in the development of your job training program. Next slide. Your training program outline should include, again, curriculum topics, the number of course hours, duration of courses, proposed training cycle start and end date, schedule, a list of certifications that participants will be eligible to attain, and the major training tracks. You may have one or multiple tracks. Next slide. Your milestone schedule should indicate start times and completion dates of significant tasks under your program, such as outreach, procurement of a contractor, recruitment, frequency of classes to be offered, the length of classes, instruction, placement, and tracking. Next slide. Attach general support letters from community-based organizations, past or potential employers, organizations involved in the development of your job training program, employers who've committed a willingness to hire graduates of your program, project partners, or other stakeholders that support your proposed training. Support letters will only impact scoring of the subfactors listed in Section 5B5 of the guidelines. Letters must be received with the proposal. Letters received separately after the due date for proposal submission will not be considered. I hope there's no congressional people on the phone, but if you're trying to get a support letter from your local congresswoman or man, that's great, but usually I receive those support letters after the deadline for submission, so unfortunately we can't take those support letters into consideration. Next slide. Read entire new guidelines and follow the directions. Get mentoring from prior grantees. We have a list of all our grantees on fact sheets, which can be found on the Brownfields EPA website. Write as though the reader knows nothing about your community. Follow the instructions in Section 4 of the guidelines for application submission. Again, please follow the directions. Address all the criteria. If it doesn't apply, say so and explain why. Never leave anything blank. Avoid using acronyms and technical jargon. Follow cover letter outline, 2 pages. Use white space and obey the 18-page limit for the narrative proposal, the 2-page limit for the cover letter, and the 20-page limit for your attachment. That's a total of 40 pages. Pages in excess of the page limits will be removed and won't be evaluated. No photos or graphics. Limit your attachments to required and relevant documents and letter. I always say quality over quantity. Just because you have the full 20 pages for your attachment, if it's a bunch of nonsense and not high quality, it's not necessarily better. Electronic submission of applications is allowed, as already discussed. Next slide. Too much information is not necessarily a good thing. Do not restate the evaluation criteria. Respond clearly and directly to the questions in the guidelines. Although your responses may seem repetitious, you need to respond as many times as asked. Some reviewers may not always cross-reference responses. Address all the criteria, even if it doesn't apply. Create a game plan for each section in the application. Identify the number of questions presented in each subsection. Highlight keywords that you'll want to use in your response. Identify information that you'll need to research or obtain to answer the questions. For pertinent sections, design the actual plan you'll implement if you receive the EPA grant. Use your plan to answer the questions. A strong understanding of the concepts and well-thought-out plans will come through in your proposal. Next slide. This is our timeline. So October has passed. The guidelines aren't out yet, so again, I anticipate the final request for proposals or the application guidelines will be released. I'm hoping it'll probably be like 3 weeks from now. January 2011, I think the 28th of January is our anticipated deadline for submission of proposals, and we anticipate making the final grant announcement in the spring, probably in mid-April. Next slide. Threshold criteria are evaluated by your EPA region. You may be contacted to clarify information in your application. I recommend that if you are going to apply, that you contact your regional job training coordinator, and their information is found in the application guidelines. Programmatic capability will be scored by the region. National panels will convene and rank your proposals. The Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response Assistant Administrator is the selection official, and he will make the final determination. Next slide. Begin thinking about your application. Conduct an employer survey. These are things that you can do now. Don't wait. Keep an eye out for the guidelines. Again, disregard October. We're looking in a few weeks. Do not provide template letters of support. Try to get individualized support letters. Hold a public meeting. Contact partners for assistance in preparing and or reviewing your application. And contact us with any eligibility questions you have. Next slide. These are your regional job training coordinators that you should contact if you have additional questions. Once the application guidelines are live, we are not going to be able to provide individual assistance. We can't provide unfair competitive advantages to applicants. So we need to provide assistance on an equal basis to everyone. If you applied in the past and you never got a debriefing on why your proposal was unsuccessful, I suggest you pick up the phone tomorrow and contact your regional job training coordinator and try to find out why so you can get some feedback. Some other web-based resources that we have. We do have some frequently asked questions which are posted on our website. I'm going to update those, but there's some information from past years that you might find helpful. We also have a job training report. It's called Improving Land and Life, 10 Years of Investment in EPA's Job Training Program. There's a lot of good information in there. Again, we have a list of previous grantees. And what else? I really recommend that you look at the Brownfields Toolbox, which is on our website. It was developed by the Hazardous Materials Training and Research Institute. It's a very useful tool for those interested in developing a Brownfields or environmental job training program. HMTRI also has PLC calls or private learning community conference calls for those interested in developing a program, and also for experienced grantees. Each other week, I think the calls are held biweekly, they cover a range of topics, whether it's recruitment or placement or curriculum development, what have you. So we have a lot of great resources out there. And then our final last slides, this is a graduation ceremony here from our Tucson grant. This is what the program's all about. This is the big day, graduation. If you've never attended a graduation ceremony for one of these programs, it's a really great thing to do. So with that, I will now open it up for questions.
Great. Thank you very much. As a reminder, those of you on the phone lines, we're going to give you instructions in a minute to take yourself off of mute and ask the question directly. Those of you, though, who have been streaming the audio, and we do have over 100 people from actually all over the world that are participating today, if you haven't done so already, you can use the question mark button that's located at the top of your slides to have a new window open up and type up your comments or questions. So again, I'll start with the people on the phone. I have a number that were already submitted online, but I'm going to give you guys a chance to continue typing up your questions or comments now. You just want to be sure to disable that pop-up blocker on your web browser so that when you click the question mark button, the new window will open up. You'll be able to type up your comment or question. So for with that, let's start again with the individuals on the phone lines. If you are on the phone and you have a comment or question for Joe, go ahead and hit #6 or unmute your line, and you can ask your question directly. Again, it's #6. Any comments or questions on the phone?
Don't be shy.
Okay, well, while the individuals on the phone lines work up their nerves, I'm going to start with some questions that came in online. And the first one is actually an international question that's coming in from Pakistan. And they ask, is this training just for the environmental workforce of the United States, or can anyone outside of the USA apply?
Right. This grant money is only for organizations in the United States.
Excellent. The next question comes in from Aiken Technical College in South Carolina, here in the USA, and they ask, if we are providing the training as a contract to the entity that received the fiscal year 10 grant, and I don't know if that was a typo and they meant, I think they did mean fiscal year 10, can the college be eligible to apply for the fiscal year 11 grant? So in other words, they're a college, they're providing the training as a contract to a different entity in fiscal year 10, and they want to know if the college can apply directly for the grant themselves in fiscal year 11.
Right. So if you're not the actual fiscal recipient of the FY10 money, then you would be eligible to apply. So yes, you would be eligible to apply. But I would caution that you try to target a different population. We don't want to duplicate existing programs that are already out there. So we've had this actually happen in the past, and we had the contractor apply for the funds. They were a nonprofit, and they were successful.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Eureka, California, and they ask, what happens if you fall short of the minimum placement rate?
You mean after your grant, if you are selected?
I believe that is, but if the individual asking the question could clarify. I believe, though, that the intent of the question is after you receive the grant, if you don't make the minimum placement rate, what are the results or impacts?
Well, hopefully that won't happen. We know that sometimes it does, even with our most successful grantees, but, you know, again, we have great training organizations, and we have some great grantees out there, but unfortunately, there just aren't jobs available at the end of the, you know, training program. So if you really, really think that employment is not going to result from your training program, then you might not want to apply. I mean, I hate to say it, but if you are awarded a grant, you know, we'll try to work as closely as possible with you. We have a lot of resources out there. We've had community-based organizations that started from scratch. They were frightened. They didn't know what they were doing. And now they're running super successful training programs. So.
Okay, excellent. The next question asks, what are the other type of environmental training programs that are being offered by EPA other than through the Brownfields program? So I guess he's wondering if other cleanup programs here within the agency are offering similar types of job training, or is it just Brownfields?
Well, again, we took Brownfields out of the title this year, but this is really the only agency job training grant opportunity. Under the Superfund program, they have the Superfund Job Training Initiative, but that's really delivered through contractual assistance. That's not a grant opportunity. So we are really it for the EPA. The National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences gives out millions of dollars in grant funding, but that's more kind of health and safety focused. I would say that our grants are kind of more environmental, integrative. You know, we're trying to reach out to other media, whether it's the Office of Air, the Office of Water, and I'm sure you also know that the Department of Labor has awarded millions and millions of dollars, as well as the Department of Energy. But I think that what makes this program different is that local nonprofit or community-based organizations are eligible, where they might not be eligible for DOE or DOL money in some cases. We do want to support local workforce investment boards. They are eligible, but we don't limit it, our funds, to just WIBs. So we're it for the EPA.
Great, thanks. I have a number of questions that also have come in online. I'm going to take a break after we get through those and double check with the phone participants. But if you're on the phone and you'd rather submit the question electronically, you're welcome to do so. Again, anyone who's looking at the questions or probably looking at the slides through a web browser window, if you click the question mark button above your slide, you can go ahead and type up a comment or question that I'll read on your behalf in the new window that opens up. If you're having problems with that, you can also email or reply directly to my confirmation email from today, and I'll read your question off the email. So with that, I'm going to go back to the questions that have been submitted online. And the next one asks, can EPA help review our application, or are there firms that you can recommend to help review the application?
We will not review applications. There are tons of resources out there. Again, I would suggest that you contact existing or established training programs. We have a list of all our past grant recipients on our website, and also the resources that I listed at the end of the presentation, such as resources available through the Hazardous Materials Training Research Institute.
Okay, great. The next question, again, is coming in from Midwest City in Oklahoma. And they ask, in the core curriculum portion, does wastewater plant training fall into the acceptable program?
Right. This is something I actually forgot to mention. So in the past, we have supported supplemental training such as other non-hazardous waste-related training, such as wastewater treatment facility operator training. I do not have a final answer, unfortunately, right now on whether or not we're going to be able to support wastewater treatment facility operator training or training related to air or, you know, retrofitting of engines, for example. We also have kind of a sticky issue with energy-related training because Congress appropriates funds to the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, really for hazardous and solid waste-related work. So it's kind of a stretch for us to say that we'll support weatherization or energy auditing. Right now, I would anticipate that you plan that it will be eligible, but there might be a surprise, unfortunately, and that's one of the issues I'm working on right now. I hope I answered your question.
I think you did. Thank you. And again, if you need clarification for any of the questions that have been asked, you can certainly go ahead and submit a further comment or clarifying statement, and we'll read those out loud. The next question is coming in from Utica, New York, and they ask, are all grant participants required to use the ACRES, it's A-C-R-E-S acronym, online reporting system? And if so, who should you contact about gaining access and training for this system?
Right. So if you are awarded a grant, then you will be required to submit reports on the number of individuals trained and the number of individuals placed, as well as the average hourly starting wage through ACRES. Compared to other grant programs, our reporting requirements are pretty simple. It's just a matter of getting in the system, and we'll provide all that information to you. But you would be required to enter that information into ACRES if you're awarded a grant.
Okay. And the next question, I think, is related also to a review process, but a slightly different spin. This one's coming in from Arlington, Virginia. And they ask, will we be notified if anything is wrong or missing from my application, or is the application simply discarded without any opportunity to repair a simple mistake?
I mean, we try to be as clear as possible about what's required to submit in your proposal. If it's an eligibility issue, then we may contact you. Like if you're a nonprofit and you forget to submit your 501c3 status, which I hope you wouldn't do, then maybe we contact you and say, you know, we need proof of your 501c3 status. But in general, I don't think we really have any of those issues. Again, pay careful attention to the directions. It'll tell you about all the attachments that you need to submit and all the ranking criteria are there. Make sure you respond to everything.
Okay, the next question is also coming in. This is an international question, and they ask, can we say that this type of training is based on the community participation towards environmental issues? I'm not quite sure exactly what he's asking for in this particular question. But the exact wording says, can we say that this type of training is based on the community participation toward environmental issues?
Well, I would say that this is a strong community-based program, absolutely. I mean, it was really designed to benefit local residents. That's why the training program or grant funding was really created. So, you know, the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council and the EPA co-sponsored a series of public dialogues throughout the United States in the early 90s. They solicited feedback from local residents about, you know, their concerns about brownfields and hazardous waste sites. And they developed a report, and in that report of recommendations to the EPA about the development of the brownfields program, one of the recommendations was on creating some kind of training or employment opportunities for residents. So.
Great. The next question is coming in from Lafayette, Louisiana, and they ask, you mentioned that 2 to 3 cycles of training is recommended in the grant. Is that per grant cycle, in other words, over 2 years? So if we train 75 people, we must ensure that 70% of those employees are placed in full-time positions?
Yes, we don't, you know, I want to be careful. I don't want to tell you this is how many cycles you have to have. We don't have a required number of cycles or tracks. I mean, you really design it. But if you look at the FAQs that are on our website, we try to kind of get to the issue of what's the anticipated number that should be trained. 70% placement is, that's a requirement. So you need to anticipate to place at least 70% of individuals or your program. I would say in the past, we would have 2 to 3 cycles over a 2-year project period. But this year, again, we've added $100,000 to the grant fund. So rather than training 20 individuals per cycle, I recommend that you try to bump that number up a bit.
Okay, the next question comes in from Needles, California, and they ask, are priorities given to grantees that partner with other organizations, for example, a tribal rehabilitation program and a local community college?
Absolutely. I mean, this program is really about partnerships, so absolutely, absolutely. We really look for partnerships between community-based organizations, local government, or in your case, tribal government, a workforce investment board, or a training center or organization. So, yes.
And the last question that I see that's been submitted online, although you guys can continue to type them up as we go along because we still have a little bit of time, but right now the last one I have in the queue, also coming in from Louisiana, asks, are the job training grants awarded evenly per region or based upon the region and population size?
I would say generally that the highest ranked proposals are funded. We do take into consideration other factors such as geographic distribution among EPA's 10 regions, whether the applicant is a tribe. We try to look at urban versus rural distribution and whether the project might, you know, help address concerns from Hurricane Katrina, for example, or a natural disaster, or if a project is going to target veterans. We take those other factors into consideration, but I've been working on this for over 6 years now, and history has shown that really it's the top proposals are funded. the top-ranked proposals in order are funded.
Okay, thank you. Again, this is a last call for those of you on the phone lines. If you have a comment or question, you can take yourself off of mute. If you've used our mute command, you want to hit #6 to unmute your line. And while we wait just a few more seconds, if there are any other comments or questions from our streaming simulcast participants or those of you who don't want to talk out loud, you can certainly continue to type them up. And we'll wait just a minute or two more to make sure that we don't have any other looming questions. So again, if you're on the phone lines, #6 to unmute your line. You can just go ahead and directly ask a question. And if for some reason you do have other questions or comments, just a reminder that perhaps you didn't have anything hit you now, but as you go through the application process, if something does occur to you, as I mentioned, the contact information for myself as well as our instructor will be available on the seminar homepage. So you are welcome to follow up with either of us by email, and we'll be sure to get a response to you as soon as we can.
Hello, I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
My question is how is community being defined? Is it just with a city? How is that being used? The term being used?
It's a good question, actually. And I mean, it's kind of theoretical, but usually I would try to focus on a specific neighborhood or 2 to 3 neighborhoods.
Okay.
If you're in New York, you can focus on a portion of Brooklyn or a portion of Harlem, or if you're from New Orleans, you could focus on Central City or a specific ward. You get to choose that. But yeah, if you're in a huge metropolitan area and you're from Boston, I would suggest you don't say, oh, well, we're going to target the entire city of Boston.
No, we're in a smaller much smaller area.
Okay. So if you're in a rural town or a small town or you're a tribe, I mean, you can just define it as, you know, we're going to work in our county. That's fine.
Okay, so we could do it parish-wide if we wish to.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question from Connecticut. Regarding the budget, can you kind of define what, when you're talking about the budget, about the personnel costs?
Right. I mean, personnel costs are eligible. So as our fringe benefits, costs for the training provider or the instructor, that would be an eligible cost. I think that the National Review Panel, if you have an executive director in your organization who's not doing anything related to your project, but you want to pay that person 40% of your grant funds, I don't think that would go over too well. I mean, you have limited grant funds, so, you know, we really want to see those grant funds go directly towards training or towards personnel that are working directly on the training program. I also mentioned that administrative costs are not eligible. However, if you have, you know, make sure that you read more about administrative costs. If you have, you know, a clerical staff person who is working on financial reporting related to this grant, or someone who is working on training and placement data related to this grant, that would be an eligible cost. Even though they're defined as an administrative assistant, if they're working directly on this project, then a percentage of their work could be paid with these grant funds.
So, just for clarification, so if you have a person who's two individuals, who one is partial, be responsible for supervising, coordinating, and doing all the reporting, and one other another. A worker responsible for making sure all the paperwork is done, following up on the client, make sure everything being set up, training, those are, that could be applied to it, correct?
Right. You could cover someone who's working on recruitment or a placement coordinator. If you're going to contract out for that, or subgrant out for that. Those are eligible uses of funds. Absolutely.
Excellent. Additional questions on the phone lines? Again, it's #6. You can just ask your question directly. Okay, I do have a couple of questions that were emailed to me, and just making sure it doesn't look like I have any more that have been submitted online, so I'm going to go through the ones that were emailed directly to me. And the first one asks, is online training acceptable, or does it have to be an in-person classroom delivery of the training?
You know, that's a really good question, and I know that we've spoken about this a little bit before as a program, and I think we don't have a clear answer on that one. I think it depends on what type of training it is. But if you want to email me directly and give me more specifics on your question and what type of training it is, I mean, if there's a really strong health and safety component to it, then we might want to see that training delivered in person. But we also know that if you're in a rural community, I don't know, maybe this person's from Alaska and they want to do online training because, you know, travel costs are so high. Send me an email and I'll try to give you a more clear response on that.
And just a reminder, Joe's contact information and email are found on the seminar homepage. You can email me directly, which reply to my confirmation email, and I'll forward it on to Joe. Okay. The next question that was emailed in, they ask, and this is also related, can grant funds be used to train trainers to then teach the required curriculum, for example, RPP and HAZWOPR?
I think that ideally we want to see the limited grant funds going to trainers who are already certified to provide this training. I mean, it's limited grant funds. I think we might take it into consideration, but that's also a really good question. I feel like I know who's asking these questions.
Well, along those lines, we have more questions that have come in, and they ask if a participant is already HAZWOPR certified, can you use the training or can you use HAZWOPR recertification as an acceptable substitute?
Right. So if someone already has HAZWOPR certification but they need refresher training, you could use a portion of your grant funds to deliver training to those that need refresher training. But the majority of your grant funds should really be focused on training those who are terminally unemployed and have no certification. Or little training.
Okay. And then the last question that I have sent in by email asks, is emergency medical technician basic an acceptable training if there is a need for the project?
Yes. As is first aid training or CPR, yes.
Okay, great. Those are the end of the questions that I've had emailed in. I don't see any more that have been typed up or submitted electronically online. We'll just do one last call to those of you on the phone lines. If you have a question, go ahead and hit #6, and you can ask your question to Joe directly.
The questions are getting better.
And, of course, as we said, if you don't have a question now, but all of a sudden it occurs to you later on, again, either email myself or Joe directly, and we'll get you a response as soon as we can. So I don't see or hear anything else coming in on the line. So, Joe, I'm going to ask if you have any closing statements or comments that you'd like to make before we formally wrap things up today.
Just good luck to everybody. Don't be overwhelmed. You have time. I recommend that if you want to get some one-on-one assistance or, you know, you have a lot of other questions, contact your regional job training coordinator, contact other grant recipients out there, because once the RFA is issued, we're not going to be able to provide one-on-one assistance.
Hey, Joe, I have a question.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Louisiana has a lot of questions today. I do have a question on the lead renovation. currently y'all require us to have the certification through the EPA to do that training. If we submit an application but we're not currently approved through the EPA, would that be acceptable as being approved through you guys, or we have to go through the separate process?
I'm a little confused as, I mean, the way you worded your question. For example, we have a grantee in New Orleans.
Right.
And they wanted to deliver the RRP training.
Right.
Well, there wasn't a local certified RRP instructor, but I think they got an instructor from Alabama to come down to New Orleans and provide the training. So I think my answer to you would be no, that just because you have a grant with us, you're not, that doesn't relieve you of, like, not having a certification.
Okay, so the reason I'm asking that is because we're currently trying to get certified in that RRP status, and it's just cost-effectively, it costs a lot of money to pull somebody in here from Alabama. Obviously, you know.
Right.
And because the threshold of 2 months is going to approach fast, I didn't know if we had the time to continue with that or just scratch it.
You have to comply, unfortunately. We are the EPA, and we really want to make sure that individuals going through this training program have the new RRP certification. And it also, for those on the line, if you're traditionally, most of our programs have provided lead abatement certification, the 40 hours. It's going to differ state by state. So if you're doing the full 40 hours, that might cover part of the new RRP. So, you know, if you have specific questions like that, you can ask me, and I'll try to get an answer from the lead program because I don't know the laws in each state. But also, if you are awarded a grant, you know, I think that we can try to find ways to minimize costs. There's a lot of training programs in Louisiana, and I know they're doing this training. So whether I have to pick up the phone and call Dillard University or Limitless Destas in New Orleans to find out what they did or how they got that training, I'll do it.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, again, are there any other comments coming in by phone? Okay, well, with that, I do see that there was one more comment that was submitted online, and that actually works perfectly with where I will direct everyone. And if I could ask everyone to move along to the very final slide in the presentations. It's slide number 67, and I referenced this slide earlier when we started things today. It's a resources and feedback slide. Now, if you are looking for copies of today's PowerPoint presentation, as well as other resources and websites that are related to today's topic and were mentioned throughout the presentation, the first link you want to take a look at is the additional resources link. So if you're looking at the slides online, you can click on that hyperlink text. And you can also find the very same link at the bottom of the seminar homepage. So if you, again, look at the confirmation email or reminder email from me, if you follow the URL to the seminar homepage, at the bottom you'll see the links to additional resources page. And that's where you can download today's PowerPoint in a variety of formats, from PowerPoint to PDF. Also on the final slide is that link to our short feedback form, where if you have just a few minutes, we do ask that you submit that feedback form. Again, those of you who are looking to receive credit for participating today, although we don't offer any through CLUIN as part of your records and the accrediting institution requiring you to get training hours under your belt, they may accept a copy of today's PowerPoint materials and a registration email or the seminar homepage printout, along with the confirmation email that you can have sent to you after you submit feedback to show that you did successfully listen and provide feedback on today's event. So if you are looking at a printed copy of today's materials, again, both of these links are available in the reminder email from me and at the bottom of the seminar homepage. So you can certainly refer back to that feedback form or additional resources page at another time. So with that, I will officially close out today's session. I just wanted to extend my thanks to today's speaker, who comes from the EPA's Brownfields Program, as well as EPA Region 6, for organizing today's session. And I want to thank all of the numerous participants we've had, actually, from all over the world who joined in today. And I just wanted to thank you all again for hopping on. And if you did find this to be a useful session, it has been recorded and it will be archived. So if there are colleagues or individuals you think that would benefit from this, in about 2 weeks you'll be able to download or replay the seminar in a few different formats from the CLUIN website. So you want to be sure to check out cluin.org/training and follow the links to the archive training page in about 2 weeks to get a copy of today's session. You should also receive an automated email from us as well to let you know as soon as that archive is available. So I want to thank everybody again for joining me today, and this will be the formal conclusion of today's seminar. I hope you have a great rest of your afternoon. Thanks, and hope to hear or see you on a future CLUIN seminar.